Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to Talking Business, a podcast produced in Melbourne, Australia. The podcast is available on the Acast app, the Apple Podcast Store, or wherever you go to get your podcasts. Or you can get it at the Business Acumen website at www.businessacumen.biz. I am Leon Gettler. My job is to review and monitor the week's news in business, finance and economics. I bring it all to you every week. This is episode number 20 in our series for 2019, and today's date is Friday, June the 14th.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
First, I talked to Chris Croker, the Managing Director of Impact Investment Partners, and they're setting up an exciting and innovative Indigenous Infrastructure Investment Fund. And then I'll be talking to ComSec economist Craig James about what trends we can expect in the market for the week ahead. But now, let's talk to Chris Croker. Chris Croker, tell us about the Indigenous Infrastructure Investment Fund.
The Indigenous Infrastructure Investment Fund is quite an exciting concept. Built on my personal experience. I'm Aboriginal. My family's from the Central Desert. I grew up in many Aboriginal communities.
You're a Luritja man.
Luritja man, yeah. So I'm seeing firsthand the deficit or deficiencies in Indigenous communities, which you think, well, the times have moved on from, previous generations where there were a lot of systematic issues. You think today, modern society, we all enjoy access to the same opportunities and essential services, such as water and housing and electricity and access to medical care and things like that.
But which, of course, doesn't happen in the Indigenous communities.
It doesn't happen, that's right. That deficit is still there. I was just actually talking to a good friend of mine from Sydney, and she works in women's justice and health issues, healthcare. She's been in the industry, that service area, for all her life, 40 years or something like that. Those deficiencies are actually in our big cities as well. It's not just confined to the very remote regions, such where my family live in the central desert, where it's literally hundreds, if not thousands of kilometres from the major cities. It's actually in Sydney and Melbourne as well. Playing out in different degrees, we see it, manifest. So the infrastructure fund is a concept that we've been working on to utilise both Indigenous capital. I can explain this concept around Indigenous capital and what I call socially minded capital. So capital that is already invested in doing good and through the ESG type focuses, whether it's in equities or investments, direct in properties and assets, utilising those two pools of capital to actually invest in or finance better solutions to deliver better social outcomes. Provide access to clean drinking water. We can fix that lack of clean drinking water, safe drinking water, by our investment in an engineering solution to provide, treat the water that's already there, remove the impurities, and deliver better quality water to the town.
So tell us about this Indigenous capital. What is it?
So coming out of, different determinations, and we just had Mabo Day yesterday.
That's right, June the 3rd.
Which is the anniversary of the Mabo decision. So that's recognising, right, overturning this quite foreign concept, and I used to, when my family, we used to joke as kids, how can the constitution be based on the fact that there was no one here before colonisation when clearly my family, we were here forever, it didn't really make sense. But that decision's overturned. Even preceding Mabo decision and the Native Title Acts that were in place at the federal and the state levels now, but previously to that, going back to Menzies, I think, in the Northern Territory, where there's a lot of Aboriginal people still living on their traditional lands. There's a unique piece of legislation, federal legislation, called the Northern Territory Land Rights Act. Basically, recognising that the land has always been occupied by Aboriginal people and there's an ownership over that land. So basically, leading from either native title determinations linked to the Mabo decision or through, the federal government land rights acts, which apply to the Northern Territory and to the very remote northern aspects of South Australia, where they have the Anangu Pitjantjatjara Yidgarri lands, the APY lands. There's vast tracts of Australia that are, owned by Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander groups. And with that land ownership, of course, comes a revenue stream. And so in certain cases, that revenue stream has been building up over time.
Revenue streams to draw from what?
So say some of my family live at our traditional owners of Uluru, Mutajula. So Uluru has just recently celebrated a significant milestone of being handed back to the community for, I think it's 30 years now. I remember going with my mother to the handback ceremony. I think it was 87 or 88 or something. I need to actually look up the date. But it was, when I was younger, I was about 10 or 15 or something. So my family went, and it was quite a significant event for the Aboriginal communities. So we own the national park, basically.
And so they get revenue from tourists?
That's it. We basically own and manage the national park. So when the tourists come in, and, Uluru is arguably one of Australia's most famous tourist destinations. When tourists go to the national park, they pay a park entry fee. That park entry fee goes to running the national park, so providing all the amenities and services, making sure it's managed environmentally, but also managed culturally, and in recognition of the land ownership, some of that fee will then be returned to the traditional owners.
And then there are the ESG funds from Super.
Definitely, there's many of our super funds now provide the option. Would you like to invest your superannuation in equities, real estate, or ESG type funds? Some of our early research going back a couple of years indicated that in Australia there was potentially more funds that were earmarked for ESG investments than there were actually reliable, solid ESG investments to be made. So that's part of our early work. We were actually like looking at finding or developing ESG investments so that other investors can invest in. We've moved on from that model, yeah.
So what sort of investments can they make under the fund?
Under the fund? Or
under the fund.
So our fund is specifically limited to infrastructure. And depending on your financial background, you either refer to it as infrastructure or social infrastructure or core and core plus. So it's basically infrastructure is distinct from equities investments, of course, you're investing in stocks, or business investments, which some people would say was, you know, a VC style investment. Infrastructure is in, you know, hard assets, bricks and mortar facilities, that are typically underwritten by pretty long-term contracts to deliver that service. So it's quite common for infrastructure, say investment in power generation, to be underwritten by at least a 10-year contract to provide a certain quality power, a certain amount of power over a defined period of time, which then makes infrastructure typically a safer investment that can be counter-cyclical to the market.
And so we're really here talking about investments in water, power, and housing.
Definitely. So we have already identified many investments, and some right through to still in the concept phase, right through to pre-feasibility, feasibility, and now, you know, execution, about to, you know, execute on a project. And they range from things like, you know, out in the remote regions, access to clean drinking water and reliable electricity is an issue. It's still an issue today. And I think that issue still persists even despite quite considerable government expenditure.
And what's really exciting about this is it's not just for remote communities. It could also apply to communities in Sydney and Melbourne, which are in need.
In need, yeah, that's right. And it's maybe a slightly different need. So when we talk, you know, the investments that we currently have in the metro regions, it's like providing an investment in a medical hub that will provide better medical services to the Aboriginal community, but also it improves the efficiency of that services, which actually realises a lower cost position or subsidy requirement by, you know, the Department of Health and the like. So it's actually, we can provide a better medical service, but at a more efficient basis. So it's actually a win-win for the, you know, the typical funders of that service. And then we also get a more holistic delivery of health services as well.
What a wonderful notion that is, because it really does empower the Indigenous communities, doesn't it?
It definitely does, and it empowers at a couple of different levels. One of the aspects that we set up with our fund is that we are specifically targeting that we raise 50% of the capital required from Indigenous investors. This Indigenous capital. So they, rather than having their capital deployed in stocks and bonds or in sitting in term deposits, they're actually helping to actively address some of the social issues. And of course, when we run the asset, the medical centre or electricity, a key component of what we specifically offer over a typical infrastructure investor is that we will work with the Indigenous community to make sure a lot of those services in management or asset management and care and the maintenance services are delivered by the community. So there's direct involvement at many levels, both from the ownership through to the operation stage as well.
So the community will have a role in managing it?
That's right. Different roles, you know, it depends asset to asset, and then the the types of services, because of course managing a medical hub is different from, you know, maintaining a renewable energy project.
But it's all possible.
One of the things that's a lot of people don't realise, and I've seen it through my personal life and my professional life, that I think today there's not one single profession where we don't have Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people working at quite, you know, senior levels. So Aboriginal community, Indigenous community, we can deliver everything that's required. We don't have scale and we may be new to that type of business, but, you know, given the opportunity and maybe even bringing the different, you know, community-based mindset to the delivery of those services actually results in a better outcome for all anyway.
Well, Chris Croker, that is just fantastic, and congratulations, and that's wonderful.
Thank you. Yeah, look forward to speaking again soon.
And now let's talk to CommSec economist Craig James.
Okay, well, Craig, what can we expect from the markets this week?
Well, it's going to be a very interesting week. I suppose we're a little bit light on in terms of the amount of information, top shelf type, you know, economic information. So really we don't have any indicators like retail spending or building approvals. Yes, but I suppose what the focus will be is on the Reserve Bank board minutes, you know, so on Tuesday. Now, these are the minutes from the meeting which decided to cut interest rates for the first time in almost 3 years. So it's going to be an interesting discussion to be able to see what the Reserve Bank board members were discussing at that time, what they're thinking, and perhaps in terms of their future plans. But those board minutes come out on Tuesday. We've got the house price index, the residential price index is from the Bureau of Statistics also out on Tuesday. That's very much backward looking. We know that the world has changed since the federal election. If you look at the CoreLogic figures, we've actually seen gains in home prices in places like Melbourne, Sydney and Adelaide since the election. So to look back at the March quarter really isn't going to provide, you know, too much information. But I think the highlights this week are the board minutes coming out on Tuesday. The other highlight, you know, is the skilled vacancy figures on Wednesday. We do know now that the Reserve Bank is really focused on the job market, the expectation about where employment is going. Certainly, yeah, that's provided by skilled vacancies, one of the leading indicators of the job market. And it has been a little bit soft, you know, sort of in recent months as well. But we'll be looking some early indicators whether, you know, sort of we're seeing a pickup in terms of future employment. Of course, if we do get a pickup in terms of employment, it looks as though the unemployment rate's coming down, then the Reserve Bank will be keen to stay on the interest rate sideline.
Of course, we had right. The unemployment figures from last week.
Well, we certainly did. And the problem, I suppose, with the unemployment figures, you know, the monthly figures that come out from the Bureau of Statistics, is they are somewhat backward-looking rather than forward-looking. If some business is going to put on staff, it basically makes the decision, then it goes through the hiring process, and by the time that the person has got on to the staffing levels, you know, so it may be something like 5 or 6 months after the initial decision. So we can't rely too much in terms of the job figures coming out from the Bureau of Statistics. I think we have to be forward-looking. I think that's something that the Reserve Bank certainly needs to do, and that's why skilled vacancies, yes, are going to be important. Of course, yes, so the other thing to focus on, yes, in the coming week, is on Thursday we've got a speech by the Reserve Bank Governor. Now, clearly he's trying to provide a lot more information than he has in the past. He gave us that clear indication that interest rates were going to come down, and he followed through on that in terms of cutting interest rates. So what we have on Thursday is the Reserve Bank Governor giving a speech, and he's giving that speech after the employment figures coming out from the Bureau of Statistics, the board minutes are out on Tuesday, and the skilled vacancies on Wednesday. So if he's going to send a signal that we'll get another interest rate cut in July, we may get that signal on Thursday.
Well, indeed, the market is actually factoring in another, at least one other interest rate cut, and some are even saying there'll be a third in February.
Yeah, I think some of the economists are getting a little bit far in front of themselves. Our view is that the Reserve Bank perhaps can do a little bit more, but I think what we've also got to remember is that the world did change on May the 18th. Yes, the new economy started May the 19th. So if Labor had have got into power, there may have been changes in terms of taxation. Yes, there may have been changes in terms of negative gearing and capital gains tax and in terms of franking credits. Those proposals clearly are not going to be advanced now with the coalition government in charge. I think what we immediately saw is that people said, OK, we've got the government that we're used to. It's back to business. And so now we can go forward with a lot more certainty. And of course, there had been concerns about the election. It could have been a very close affair. It could have been a hung parliament. But we've got a clear result now. And the hope is that the Labor opposition will start supporting some of the coalition's plans. I think the coalition does have a mandate to be able to put through its tax changes. And I think a lot of businesses, a lot of investors and consumers would love that certainty, those tax cuts being passed so they can plan ahead. But I think now we've just got to be mindful that the economy has gone through that soft spot. We're coming out the other side, and the Reserve Bank's got to be careful that it doesn't overstimulate the economy, because we do know that taxes are going to be cut. We do know that APRA has made some changes in terms of mortgage serviceability. So the fact that the Reserve Bank has also cut interest rates shows that there's a lot of stimulus being put into the economy at the current time.
So you would expect property prices will start increasing, or that they've bottomed out?
Well, I think they have bottomed. As to whether we're going to see a significant rise, it gets down to the supply-demand balance. There's still a fair bit of supply to come on in terms of the Sydney, Melbourne markets in particular. But we do know in the buoyant days when there was strong demand for homes and they weren't being supplied, the supply did respond. But of course, supply always responds with a bit of a lag. So we've got to wait for the new homes to be built, significant increase to go through and then come out the other side. But what we do know since the election that investors are out again kicking tyres. They're going to provide a bit of competition for first home buyers. And we do know in terms of the CoreLogic data that since the election that we have had some gains in Sydney, Melbourne, Adelaide, prices. Overall, we're continuing to see gains in places like Canberra and Hobart. So there are more and more signs that home prices are bottom. Whether they run along the bottom there for a period of time remains to be seen as we go through that supply-demand balance. But if we do get much more increase in terms of demand from investors and owner-occupiers, then we could start to see those home prices creeping higher.
Well, that'll be interesting. And, of course, the market's had a big boost from what's happening on Wall Street as well. Wall Street's been having a good run.
Well, certainly we have seen some good gains in terms of the share market. It is quite interesting. You look at the Australian share market. The Australian share market has outperformed the US market so far this year. So we've had gains around about 12% for the US and Dow Jones. For the Australian share market, we've seen gains of over 14%. Now, when you add in dividends, total returns on shares so far this year in Australia have increased by around about 16%. Now, of course, what you'd say, well, so that's just a six-month period. Is that going to be a 32% gain for the full year? Well, I think we'd probably be getting a little bit far ahead of ourselves if we took that view. Certainly, those people who are concerned about their home price, being flat or falling, in price, perhaps they should need to look at their superannuation statements. Because we have seen the share market rising, total returns on shares have also been increasing. That adds to people's wealth levels.
So, in view of what's been happening with the coalition being re-elected and the end to tax uncertainty and home prices seem to bottom out, you'd expect the market would keep on rising. Mm. Would that be right?
Well, optimism seems to be jumping out all over. I would have thought the last bit of the puzzle, I suppose, globally, is the US-China trade situation. Now, if we can get resolution in the US-China trade situation, well, then we'll have, you know, so all the components working, you know, sort of for us. It's interesting, you look in the United States at the moment, there is this expectation that's getting built in that interest rates will be cut in the United States later this year. So it's not just us here in Australia that has been cutting rates or looking to cut rates. It is happening in other parts of the globe, and it reflects, you know, sort of a mid-cycle slowdown in terms of the expansion. The fact that we have had a bit of a stalling, and I think we can, you know, sort of attribute that stalling to the U.S. China trade negotiations, the discussions there, the tariff war that they've been applying against one another. We get that one out of the road. Well, you just have to wonder what would stop, you know, not just the Australian economy, but the global economy. And clearly, investors don't like uncertainty. If you get rid of, you know, so that those last elements of uncertainty, shares are likely to move ahead, particularly, you know, sort of on the expectation that interest rates stable or perhaps, you know, it's a little bit lower, you know, and an improvement in terms of a certainty for businesses to invest, spend and employ.
Well, Craig, thank you very much for your update on what we can expect from the market this week ahead.
Thank you, Leon.
So what's happening in the news? Well, Donald Trump, the US president, has warned Xi Jinping, his Chinese counterpart, that a new round of tariffs would be levied on the country's goods if the two leaders failed to meet at the G20 summit in Japan, as trade tensions continued to simmer between Washington and Beijing. In an interview with CNBC on Monday, Mr. Trump said he believed there would be a bilateral meeting with Mr. Xi in Osaka on the sidelines of the world leaders' gathering later this month. The meeting has been widely seen as a chance for a new truce between the US and China. He also renewed his attacks on the Fed and suggested a US ban on Huawei may be scrapped as part of a trade deal. And global finance ministers failed to forge a way forward out of the $250 billion US-China trade dispute at the G20 in Japan, with a group of 20 finance leaders declaring that trade and geopolitical tensions have intensified, but failing to express a pressing need to resolve them. The ministers also agreed to compile common rules to close loopholes used by global tech giants such as Facebook to reduce their corporate taxes. Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other large technology firms face criticism for cutting their tax bills by booking profits in low-tax countries regardless of the location of the end customer. Such practices are seen by many as unfair. The new rules would mean higher tax burdens for large multinational firms, but would also make it harder for countries like Ireland to attract foreign direct investment with the promise of ultra-low corporate tax rates. However, rocky negotiations nearly aborted the issuance of a communique before the finance ministers and central bank governors gathered in Fukuoka in southern Japan, and the firmed language on trade issued in Buenos Aires last December. Global growth appears to be stabilising and is generally projected to pick up moderately later this year and into 2020, the final draft reportedly said. However, growth remains low and risks remain tilted to the downside. Most importantly, trade and geopolitical tensions have intensified. We will continue to address these risks and stand ready to take further action, the communique said. The Buenos Aires G20 summit in December 2018 launched a five-month trade truce between the United States and China to allow for negotiations to end their deepening trade war. But those talks hit an impasse last month, prompting both sides to impose higher tariffs on each other's goods as the conflict nears the end of its first year. The G20 finance leaders' final communique language excluded a proposed clause to recognise the pressing need to resolve trade tensions from a previous draft that was debated on Saturday. The deletion, which G20 sources said came at the insistence of the United States, shows a desire by Washington to avoid encumbrances as it increases tariffs on goods. The statement also contains no omissions that the deepening US-China trade conflict was hurting global growth. The International Monetary Fund warned last week that the trade conflict would cut global growth next year, and financial markets had sold off heavily as US-Sino ties soured. And Australia should unilaterally cut trade barriers, remove nuisance tariffs, and review millions of dollars in assistance to farmers, the government's top economic advisory body has found, as it warns the world trading system is under greater strain than at any time since the 1930s. A day after, global finance ministers failed to forge a way forward out of the $250 billion US-China trade dispute at the G20 in Japan, the Productivity Commission said Australia must lead by example by ditching anti-dumping measures and encouraging foreign investment by removing regulations. The Commission said Australia has continued to retreat into protectionism in some areas through $14.4 billion in annual assistance to industries that lowered its international competitiveness. And Australia's private sector is losing momentum, with business conditions well below average and weakening further, according to the National Australia Bank's monthly business survey. Business confidence jumped from 0 to 7 in May following the election and indications of a looming rate cut, but business conditions fell to 1, well below average levels and 20 points off last year's recent peak. Retail, mining, transport and utilities were the main sectors which drove the business conditions result lower in just a month. But the weaker trend is more noticeable over a two-month period, with a 6-point fall since March. From a longer-term perspective, business conditions are about 20 points below their early 2018 peak. The downbeat result was largely weighed down by a decline in trading, down 5 points, and profitability, down 4 points in May. And key Senate crossbenchers will demand the government come up with a plan to stop Australia's abhorrent energy price rises before supporting the Coalition's signature $158 billion income tax cuts in Parliament. The government will need to convince both Centre Alliance and One Nation to back the three-stage 10-year package without the support of Labor. It had hoped that personal briefings from RBA Governor Philip Lowe and Treasury executives in Adelaide last week would sway the crossbench votes its way. But the two Centre Alliance senators weren't persuaded that the government had made the case that the tax cuts alone were in the economy's best interest. They will now give the government's chief negotiator, Finance Minister Matthias Cormann, less than 3 weeks to pull together an energy proposal to ensure power price rises do not wipe out the benefit of tax cuts worth between $1,000 and $4,000 a year for middle-income earners over the next 5 years. Centre Alliance Senator Rex Patrick said if disposable income was consumed by rising power prices, you would effectively nullify the advantage of a tax cut. And Labor, meanwhile, is standing firm on its demand for the Morrison government to split the bill for income tax cuts, as the Coalition calls for the Senate to respect the verdict of voters and pass the package in full. Amid the standoff between the Coalition and Labor over the government's key election pledge, the passage of the legislation would come down to crossbench senators who are leaving open the possibility of supporting the plan. On Monday, Pauline Hanson indicated she would oppose the third stage of the government's $158 billion tax cut package, saying she was not sold on the economic argument of the boost for higher income earners. She called on the government to prioritise nation-building projects, naming a coal-fired power station, the Bradfield Water Scheme first proposed in the 1930s, and a royal commission into the family court system as key to her support. And Australians who rely on earning interest from their savings will be the biggest losers after the Reserve Bank slashed rates to a record low last week. A total of $526 billion is currently held in savings account across the nation, according to a report by financial comparison website Finder. It also found that households may lose around $1.3 billion in interest from their term deposits and savings accounts if the banks pass on the full rate of a cut of 0.25 percentage points. The hardest hit groups will be those saving for their first home or retirees relying on their savings as a form of income, said Graham Cook, Finder's Insights Manager. Mortgage borrowers, on the other hand, are the main beneficiaries of lower rates, even though many lenders opted not to pass on the full cut. In the last 2 months, more than 50 banks have already lowered their term deposit rates. And interest rates on more than 80% of savings and 44% of termed accounts are below the headline rate of inflation, with more cuts on the way following last week's reduction in cash rate, University of New South Wales analysis shows. The record low rates are a blow to 3 million households that rely on interest rates to make ends meet, such as retirees and other pensioners, and will force more than 1 million households to dip into their capital, according to analysts. These negative real rates are also expected to force many savers from cash into riskier investments, ranging from housing to stocks, particularly high dividend paying income stocks, in search of a bigger return. And Wesfarmers has outlaid $230 million to buy one of Australia's oldest and largest online retailers, Catch Group, from founders Gabby and Hezi Lubovitch. Wesfarmers has entered into an agreement to buy Catch Group for $230 million cash to accelerate the conglomerate's digital and e-commerce capabilities. Catch Group, which operates an online marketplace and owns sites such as Catch of a Day, MumGo, Grocery Run and Scoopon, will operate as an independent business unit overseen by Kmart Managing Director Ian Bailey. And AGL Energy has issued a $3.1 billion proposal to acquire telecommunications company Vocus Group a week after takeover talks with a Swedish private equity player fell through. Under the proposal, AGL would buy all of Vocus shares at $4.85 each, 40 cents lower than the offer that private equity EQT Infrastructure brought to the table in May. The bid would value Vocus at some $3 billion. And casino giant, the Star Entertainment Group, aims to cut as much as $50 million from its cost base after warning a soft economy would mean its fiscal 2019 underlying earnings will fall below last year's result. The Star said on Tuesday it expects normalised earnings before interest, tax, depreciation and amortisation, which are just for lucky streaks for neither the House nor punters, for the year ending June 30 would be between $550 million and $560 million, below the $568 million posted last year. And Eric Beecher's private media has launched its new investigative journalism team, INQ, with a staff of 12, 2 editors and 10 journalists, who will focus on deep reporting across a range of topic areas as an extension of independent digital news publisher Crikey. Subscribers to Crikey will have access to INQ. Mr. Beecher, a former editor of the Sydney Morning Herald, said the new division had more than 800 applicants for the 12 positions at INQ. Six-time Walkley winner Suzanne Smith has been brought in as consulting editor, while former Chief of Staff at Networks 10 The Project, Lauren Molan, will be inquiry editor. The team of journalists will include David Hardacre, Janine Carlick, Kirsten Drysdale, Emily Watkins, Georgia Wilkins, Justine Landis-Hanley, Charlie Lewis, Kishore Napier Raman, Amber Schultz and Chris Woods. INQ marks the return of the storied Fairfax family to the media sector. Mirinya Capital, the family investment office for John B. Fairfax and Nicholas Fairfax, has invested in the INQ venture along with Cameron Riley. The Fairfax family ended its association with Fairfax Media, which has now merged with Nine, in 2011, when Nicholas Fairfax left the publisher's board of directors and the family's stake in the business was sold. And the chief executive of waste management group Cleanaway says a pioneering trial of electric rubbish trucks in a council area in Melbourne is showing some promising signs in its early stages. The electric trucks have a range of 180 kilometres before they need to be recharged, and the first has been operating for the past few weeks in the city of Hobsons Bay, which covers 12 suburbs in Western Melbourne. Cleanaway Chief Executive Vic Bunsell said there were good signs on the operating costs for the vehicles for curbside collections, because they need to be kept low for the technology to be viable in the long term. And global ride-sharing giant Uber has named Melbourne as one of three locations around the world for its aerial taxi service trial. The service would use a network of small and electric aircraft using vertical takeoff and landing technology. A 2016 paper proposed using car park roofs and existing helipads to run the service. The Civil Aviation Safety Authority previously said the project was possible and could be introduced within 5 years. The company's Uber Air Pilot, which will also run in the US cities of Dallas and Los Angeles, aims to connect transport hubs like airports to central city sites. The rideshare company said test flights were due to start from 2020 and plans were for commercial operations to commence from 2023. The announcement was made at the company's Elevate Summit in Washington after sealing the deal with Melbourne Airport and companies Macquarie Capital, Centre Group and Telstra. And that's it for this week. And next week, I'll be talking to Daniel Lay, the CEO of cybersecurity firm Archtis, which has secured endorsement from the Digital Transformation Agency for its Cogency Gov offering, which provides security for government networks. It will be a great conversation about hacking and cybersecurity. And then I talk to AMP Capital Chief Economist Shane Oliver, looking at what's ahead in the markets. And of course, I'll be bringing you all the week's news. In the meantime, you can find me on Twitter at TalkingBizBIZZ, on Facebook and on LinkedIn. And if you want, leave a comment. Have a great week. Take care. Be good. And looking forward to bringing you Talking Business next week.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on. Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.